You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. According to the 2020 census, the population of Americans aged 65 and older saw its largest ever 10-year numeric gain, an increase of 15.5 million people from 2010 to 2020. That group also had its fastest growth rate of any decade since the 1880s, largest ever percentage point increase relative to the rest of the population. If that trend is sounding familiar, you may have heard the term silver tsunami. The baby boom generation started turning 65 back in 2011. As a result, the demand for senior services has been steadily increasing. At the same time, there's a growing need for training and recruiting workers for senior living and other services for older adults. The national trade group Argentum, which works with companies that own and operate senior living communities, forecasts that by 2040, there will be 3 million job openings for senior living. A program that started at UW-Eau Claire is working to meet the need for workers in senior services, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is that you? Do you work or have you worked in some form of senior care or services? What led you into that line of work? What kind of training did you have? Did the pandemic impact your employment at all? And did you leave that line of work? And what questions do you have about getting into professional senior care of any kind? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug Olson is president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services. For more than two decades, he was with UW-Eau Claire's nationally recognized healthcare administration program and director of the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
And Shayana Vanale is also with us. Shayana is currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire while working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. She's a member of the Vision Center Advisory Council. Shay, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Doug, take us back to the start of this healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire. What problem were you trying to solve?
Well, the healthcare administration program at UW-Eau Claire has been around since 1976 and was a very solid program, one of the few in the state for sure and in the country. We had kind of a big shift around 2000. The godfather of the program, Gene Decker, did a great job running it for many years. But then we took it to a different level and we formed what you mentioned before, this thing called CHASE, the Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence. And that program was really all about bridging providers and the university together to kind of work on really making it a solid program for students aspiring to be looking for a career in aging services leadership, and that's really been our focus.
And then here we are in 2023, Doug. What are some of the biggest challenges in bringing people into this line of work?
Well, we actually had done a lot of things at Eau Claire that we're kind of using to move forward with this new Vision Center. One of the things that we kind of really emphasized was the importance of that field experience administrative training program that allows people to go out after their time on the campus with solid curriculum and then moving to a place where they can learn the practice and the trade of leading organizations that are taking care of people's parents and grandparents. And that significant shift was we also mandated that it would be a paid experience so we could get the very best talent to do the work and learn the practice of senior living administration and do exceptional things around providing the best quality and services possible for those individuals living or needing to live in a setting or requiring services too, because the spectrum has changed a ton over the years, Rob.
And Shay, let's bring you in. What made you want to study to prepare for a job in senior living and care?
Honestly, it is not what I came into college looking for. I was a bio pre-med major, and I feel like a lot of times in high school, you kind of get two options. If you want to be in healthcare and you want to help people, you can be a doctor or a nurse. So I was like, okay, I like kids. I'm going to be a pediatrician. And then by second semester, I was kind of feeling the weight of the student loans were not going away, and I still had 8 to 12 more years of school before I could start paying those down. So I was sitting in my chemistry class the first week, and this kid next to me was like, I'm an HCAD, and I'm taking this class for fun. And I'm like, okay, well, I hate chemistry, so you're weird for taking this class for fun, because that is not me. But tell me more about HCAD. And so he told me a little bit more, and I loved the fact that they said it was a heart for caring and a head for business. So I went back to my dorm room, joined HCAD 101, and within 2 weeks I had switched my major and also joined the student org on campus and tracked Doug down and begged him to give me an internship.
HCAD, Healthcare Administration. Shay, what is it? You're also doing some work as a caregiver now. What would you say to people who, you know, maybe that line of work isn't on their radar about what a fulfilling line of work it could be?
I'd say just give it a shot. I definitely had the same fears as many people do have, that senior living homes are kind of smelly and scary and dark. And just getting inside of them, whether it's visiting a family or a friend or even volunteering, whatever you can do to get inside and realize they aren't the stigma that follows them, I think that really turns people's heads around and makes them double think about what senior living can offer them.
We're talking about a program that came out of UW-Eau Claire that tries to bring professionals into senior care, to work in various kinds of senior care facilities. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of Vision Center, and Shay Van Ael, who is going through the program at UW-Eau Claire, working in a center herself. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you worked in senior care yourself at any level? Love to hear your experiences, how you got into it, the challenges. Do you or your family member count on people doing these jobs? Are there enough of them out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Doug, we see a lot of lines of work saying, hey, we're not finding the staffing we need. We have a shortage of workers. Is that particularly true in 2023 for various kinds of senior care work right now?
Yeah, that trend in all industries right now is impacting senior living as much, if not more. I think COVID really amped up the challenges in senior living, and I think there are many heroes that rose to the occasion, but it certainly has been one of those that we've really worked hard, not only through Eau Claire, but through the Vision Center, to start changing the narrative about these jobs really fulfill purpose, provide meaning, have a variety of possibilities with them. Our particular focus, Rob, is all about finding good leaders, because good leaders, stable leaders, talented leaders help that culture and that workforce tremendously. And that's one of the areas that we see when you talked about the number of people that are not going to be in with positions that are unfulfilled. We estimate probably 250,000 of those jobs are in the leadership roles. So it's one of those things that at the core of what we're trying to do is not just replicate, but try to expand the landscape of senior living leadership programs across the country.
Shay, can you talk about the kind of things you're getting in your classes that are you hopefully preparing you to be a leader, maybe an administrator in senior care?
So one of the great things about the UW-Eau Claire program is that during your final year, what that would be on campus, you are put into a long-term care facility where you are working as the assistant administrator. So for my senior year, that is what I'm doing now. And some of the things that I've learned in classes don't compare to what you see in the facilities. You can learn about the statistics and the F tags and everything all day long, but until you're in the community, talking with the residents, talking with the staff, feeling them for what they think needs to improve, the classes don't mean much once you can get that hands-on experience.
We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care, a program started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Ael, who's currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire and working as a caregiver in the memory care unit of a senior living community. And Doug Olson is with us, formerly director of UW-Eau Claire's Center for Health Administration and Aging Services Excellence, currently president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit focused on leadership development for aging services, taking some lessons from Eau Claire and sharing them around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests, either about studying to join the senior care field or addressing the workforce gap? Are you one of the baby boomers who's hoping people go into this line of work and provide some of the services you're looking for, or maybe for a family member of yours? If you work in this industry, love to hear your perspective as well. Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Yvette Wan, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at harassment and abuse in online gaming spaces and efforts by companies and users to try and make those spaces less toxic, more friendly. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Aiden is with us in Green Bay. Aiden, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
So it's really interesting that you're talking about Ubisoft in particular, because I actually was just playing a game by them this morning. I was called For Honor. And the reason why I left this morning was because of some toxic behavior. Someone got on the mic and just started basically reciting things from Hitler's manifesto, basically. And I was curious what the speaker had to say about, there used to be a game, I don't remember what it's called, but it had a system basically where you got 1 point for every match, unless other people in the match upvoted you up to like 32, and it couldn't be your friends. And so what they used in this like system is basically every time you did a good behavior, you could get upvoted for it. And as a result, they had sort of like a more positive like community overall. But the thing is, that wasn't like a battle royale game where everyone was competing against each other. And so I was curious if she thought a system like that would work in some of like today's like service games, or if there's maybe a different way to go about it.
And thanks a lot for the call. So first of all, Yvette, that idea that he'd encountered in the past of positive reinforcement, I guess, if you behave well, people can vote for you, you get more experience points.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of game systems are incorporating more recently, and some of them are very overt, which means that you actually know what your reputation is based on the votes. And in other places, it's built into the algorithm, but you are not quite sure how it works because the company has not hidden those metrics from you. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of like dual strategies, right? Like there's the punishment, but there's also the positive reinforcement.
And then there's Aiden's experience. Just this morning, he said somebody reading Hitler quotes, it sounds like. Some moderation systems can have a lot of gray areas. I think that seems like a pretty cut and dried and easy one. If you report that, there's a good chance somebody would be blocked.
Right. I hope so. Some things are very clear, and some things there's a lot of gray area. But another thing that I think Aiden mentioned that was really interesting is that this was like an audio situation, mm-hmm. right? When we look at like traditional text is very easy to monitor based on the technology that we have right now in artificial intelligence. So in some communities, for example, you can't even type out certain words. Like they won't even let you write it in because the system recognizes it as being toxic. But when we get to audio or behavioral things where, like, for example, you're moving around with your avatar in a certain way that is offensive, these are things that are harder for the computer to detect based on the technology we have today.
Thanks again for sharing that experience, Aiden. We'll go now to JJ in Two Rivers. JJ, hello.
Hello. So as an avid gamer, I see two double-edged swords in this topic, one being anonymity is meant to protect victims, but it also then makes it difficult to punish people. The second double-edged sword is that just like domestic abuse laws, you know, these are rules and guidelines are meant to help, but they can also be abused and taken too far. You want to talk about those two double-edged swords.
JJ, thanks for the call. So that first point, Yvette, trying to protect people's anonymity online, he says, could protect victims, but then it makes it harder to block the people who abuse the system. If somebody gets banned, they can maybe just come in under another identity, and it's hard to track that. Is this part of the challenge?
Absolutely. Between anonymity and real name is what we call pseudonymity, and that's when you operate under a single username, but people cannot connect that with your offline identity. But even if you have a system like that, people can always use different emails to to create new accounts and repeat the same behavior, right? So there are some systems where that are trying to take measures against that, which include kind of trying to find detect behavioral patterns, like to see if, you know, even if it's a different account, if people are acting similarly, to try to match that based on IP or other kind of activities that they're doing. There are also ways that, for example, if you've just created a new account, like you have to wait a certain time period before you can engage in certain ways. And so there are more efforts to try to detect this kind of multiple account behavior. At the same time, when we're talking to the actual moderators, the human moderators, the things that they say that I think are really meaningful are looking at educating people rather than just banning them. Because if we look at people who are violators, there's different categories. And some people are really out there to do harm and there's not much you can really do about it. But then there are often like very young people or people who are just kind of not knowing completely what is appropriate. And instead of just banning those people and having them, you know, create a different account, there's increasing efforts in trying to educate mm-hmm. them about, like, you know, what is appropriate.
Thanks for that call, JJ. And JJ's other point, the possibility that reporting systems can lead to a different kind of abuse. And I think I've heard of this, Yvette, where a group of trolls who wants to harass that someone will, as a group, report their target as the abuser, even though they hadn't done anything in the first place. Does that make it harder to create systems that work?
Absolutely, especially when you have anything that is like user-based comments or reporting. Anything for a good purpose can also be used for bad purposes, right? And we see a lot of, we just released a paper recently on hate raids, which is looking at coordinated attacks towards other people, where so Twitch has this function where if you have a lot of viewers but you're ending your channel, you can send those viewers to another channel so that they can benefit from having more viewers. So that was like the good intention, but some people have been using this in a bad way, in which they send their viewers to a certain streamer to harass them. And so I think, like with anything in technology, I think there's always going to be these double-edged swords, and we just need to figure out, you know, how to make the best in these different situations.
We're talking about online harassment in gaming and other forums, online chats, Twitch streams, and more. Yvette Wan is with us with the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at ways to create more positive experiences along the way. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Steven is with us in Milwaukee. Steven, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I just want to say, like, I think it's also about, like, my son's 17, he does online gaming and stuff like that, and I play with sometimes too, but it's like, these people around you aren't real. And I told him, I was like, if someone says something offensive to you, just block them or leave. He's like, you have options. You don't have to, like, conform to, like, what's going on or be offended. Like, you can be upset for a second and be like, okay, this sucks. Then just get out or just block that player. Or these things exist in options. You can't just, like, they don't just, like, have these things where you're, like, you have to put up with this stuff.
Gotcha. Steven, thanks for the call. Yvette, Steven said a couple of things I want to get into. First of all, he talked to his son about how to respond when he encounters this. And that, as I understand it, Ubisoft and some other companies, part of their coaching is how to behave well. Part of it is how to engage or not engage when you do encounter harassment or abuse or racist messages or whatever online. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, depending on which game you're playing, there are also options where you can mute a certain person if they're being rude. So then even if they're saying things, like, you can't actually hear what they're saying. So that is one way to deal with it. Another thing, especially I recommend for people with, like, very young children or teenagers, is, like, suggesting that they play with friends rather than just playing with the general public at first, because, again, like, you don't know who you're going to be playing with.
And then Steven used the phrase also, these aren't real people. And I wonder if the abusers themselves, that's the mindset. Like, these are just things I'm encountering on the internet. Is that part of the goal of a positive training session, a positive message that, oh yeah, these are actual real people?
Yeah, I actually don't like to use the term like unreal for internet. And the reason for that is because what we perceive as reality, our brain isn't trained to say, oh, when I'm on the internet, this is not real. And when I'm offline, it's not real, especially for younger people, because technology and social media are embedded so much into their life. Whatever they do online is an extension of the reality. It's just taking place in a different venue. One nice way to think about it is, for example, like you at home and you at school, it's the same you, just in different environments, right? And so I think that, of course, it's easy to say, oh, you know, just, you know, brush it off because it's not anybody meaningful. But from the person who's hearing it, whether they hear it offline or online, it still has the same psychological impact and damage. So I think that it's important to understand that, like, what happens online, it's not unreal, right? It's very real. And in terms of your question regarding the violators, there are, like I said, there are a lot of different types of violators, and some people kind of view online as being, oh, this is, you know, a fictional scenario where I could do anything and get away with it, whereas other people don't make that distinction.
Thanks again for that call, Stephen. Christian joins us now in Eagle River. Oh, Christian just dropped off as we were going to take Christian. Yvette, I want to talk about who is most at risk, who is most targeted. I think again and again we see women, people of color, LGBTQ communities, particularly targets. How can we address that? How can we tackle that part of the problem?
I think one, like, the best way to think about this is that online is not particularly different from offline. So if we think about all the people who are vulnerable offline, including all the populations that you mentioned, including children, these are the same people who are going to be at the same risk online as well.
And Yvette, are you hopeful as we wrap up that we can create not just not bad online community experiences, but good and positive online experiences in the gaming community and beyond?
I am hopeful. However, I do understand, like, you know, as people, there will never be a situation where there's nothing bad, right? Mm-hmm. However, I am hopeful that as more people become familiar with this new technology, that they will understand that, you know, this is not a separate place where you can do whatever you want. It is an extension of our physical reality. But I also think that, kind of same with not just gaming, but like social media or other online activities in general, is that, you know, we can't completely just rely on companies to handle everything. And I think that, yes, companies should have a responsibility to do that. But I think also, you know, more education about, like, you know, how to conduct yourself online needs to be done at much earlier ages. And that's why I think we're also seeing a lot of improvement, because, for example, like when I was in school, like I never learned about, like, you know, how to conduct myself online. But kids these days are receiving that kind of education. So I'm cautiously hopeful that in the future people will see this as an extension of our physical reality and treat it with the respect that it deserves.
Yvette, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Yvette Wan, director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. We talked to her about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A solid skillet is a staple in any home cook's toolkit, but with hundreds of combinations of materials, coatings, and features, it's hard to know what kind to keep in your kitchen. It's Food Friday, and our next guest has put those skillets to the test. She'll tell us how to choose the best frying pans for our cooking needs and how to properly use and care for them. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your go-to skillet to cook with? What do you like about it? Have you bought pans that turned out to be duds? What questions do you have for our skillet expert? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You could also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa McManus is an executive editor for America's Test Kitchen Reviews. She also co-hosts the popular ATK YouTube series called Gearheads. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Now, you are a gear person for cooking. Could you talk us through the kind of tests you put skillets through to review them?
Well, when we test skillets or anything else at America's Test Kitchen, we buy them at retail just like everybody else. We look at what's available. We bring them into the kitchen and we use them in ways that we would typically use that piece of equipment. So if it's skillets, we might fry eggs or sear steaks or cook some vegetables. We may put it in the oven because sometimes you'll make something like a shepherd's pie and want to brown the top or toast up some breadcrumbs on top of some mac and cheese. So we'll do that. We'll also try to abuse it to see if we can find out how durable it's going to be in your kitchen over time.
What are some of the most common mistakes we might make when buying new frying pans? And mistakes, I've made a few in this category, I got to say.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think the biggest thing I always think about with a skillet is the cooking surface that's going to be available to you. Skillets are sold by their size, and that's measured from rim to rim. So they'll sell like a 12-inch skillet, which is kind of our standard go-to skillet for, you know, families of four, you know, 4 to 6 servings of cooking, even 2 servings in some cases. It's a good size to have a slightly bigger pan, not those little tiny ones you often see. But a 12-inch skillet is measured rim to rim. The way the sides slope in, if they're very steep and sloped and cupped like a bowl, you can end up with less than 8 inches of flat cooking surface on the bottom. And that's not good in a skillet. You don't want that. You don't want a wok shape in your skillet. You want a flat, broad cooking surface, because what's going to make a skillet perform well is to make sure the food isn't crowded. And you need some nice flat surface to get good and hot, to sear, and to make sure food is going to brown instead of steam.
Yeah, one of my common pratfalls with pans is when they don't heat evenly. So I'm burning over on this side and I'm not, you know, still a rare on the other side. How can we make sure we get a pan that's going to heat evenly across the surface?
A lot of that comes down to 2 things. One is you really do need to preheat your pan.
Well, I'm not very patient, but okay.
Yeah, well, really, within 4 minutes, your pan will be good and warm. You're going to put it on, say, medium heat for 4 minutes. Don't do that if it's a nonstick pan without having some oil in there. You never want to heat a nonstick pan empty. You want to put a little bit of oil in there, heat it for about 4 minutes, let it soak all the way through the pan and spread, and then you're not going to get those hot spots. The other thing you can do is make sure that the pan you're buying has a material that it's made up of that is going to conduct heat and spread it evenly through the pan. So the pan can help you or it can get in your way.
Talking to Lisa McManus with America's Test Kitchen. She is helping us choose our kitchen skillets. You can join in with your favorites, your experiences for better or worse, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Matt is with us in Madison. Matt, hi.
Hey.
What did you want to tell us about, Matt?
Yeah, so about a year ago, I picked up like an antique Griswold cast iron skillet, and I really liked using it. I use it for hamburgers, chicken breast, or just to kind of saute up some vegetables, but I've just had a really hard time trying to get seasoning to stick on it. It's like I'll do some oven treatments. I think I have a really nice layer built up, and then like once I go to like sear some chicken on it or something, I notice it'll kind of flake off where I was getting the food on there. So I was wondering if the guest has any tips for a really stubborn skillet when it comes to kind of keeping that seasoning on.
Matt, thanks for the call. Seasoning that cast iron skillet, Lisa, it's not working out for Matt.
Yeah, I think what that sounds a lot like to me is that the seasoning is too thick, that you're trying to put too heavy a coat of oil. What seasoning is essentially, if you had bare cast iron, it would look silver. And it would be very prone to rusting because exposure to air and moisture will make it rust. Seasoning is really baking on some oil, a very, very thin coat, and that makes the oil polymerize, turn into a coating. It links and bonds together with itself and with the metal of the pan and makes a nonstick coating that's natural. The big trick, though, is thin. You want a really thin coat. So I've seen a lot of systems where, well, suggestions from people to put thick coats of oil on and bake it for an hour in the oven. I did that once, did it six times in the oven for 6 hours over days. And then the first thing I cooked, it came off. It's too thick. The best thing to do is just to put the lightest, tiniest couple of drops of oil on that pan when you're done cooking with it. Don't use soap and scrub the heck out of it. Just, you know, scrub it down a little bit with just salt and some oil, rinse that out, dry it, put it on the stove, get it nice and warm, and then put really just a couple of drops of oil and get a paper towel, rub that all in. If it looks like it's all gone, that's what you're looking for. It's not gone. It's very thin. And the heat on the, of the pan, you're going to keep it on that low to medium heat. And you're going to just let it cure on there, basically. And that is what's going to give you good seasoning. And you're just going to lay a little bit on each time as you use it. You don't have to do a lot of elaborate seasoning. I would only do that the first time I got a pan is really, you know, maybe if it was an old antique pan. If it's a new pan, a lot of pans like our Best Buy from Lodge, it's black already when you get it. They pre-season it, they heat it up, they spray it with oil, they bake it on, and they've really got this down to a science. This is all they do all day long. So that pan's ready to go when you get it. And then you just maintain it. When you're done cooking, take the food out, rinse it, dry it, wipe the tiniest drop of oil in all over the interior and the exterior if it looks like it needs it. Put it back on that burner, warm it fully through, and it should look matte and not shiny, shouldn't be sticky. And that means you're going to get a nice thin coat of seasoning that's really going to release food.
Matt, hope that helps. Thanks a lot for calling in. Lisa, let's turn to those non-stick pans you mentioned. That's lots of them. That covers a lot of ground. What kind of things are we looking for in non-stick?
Well, you know, one thing that you really need to know is not all nonstick is made the same way. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's a whole bunch of different layers of quality. So there's some really basic, cheap ones. It's like when you're painting a room. If you put one layer of paint on, you might see the old color through, but, you know, it's thin. It doesn't look good. You put on, you let that fully dry, you add another coat. Nonstick is made that way. They get a pan and they'll put down one layer and cure it on, put down another layer and cure it on, kind of like that seasoning we were talking about. And if it's a really high quality nonstick, it's going to have multiple layers and it's going to be a little bit more durable than a cheap pan. So I think like one thing I would make sure is it's got a good durable nonstick coating. And we've tested a bunch of them. We do this test where we make fried eggs one after another with no fat in the pan. Heat it to a very specific temperature, drop the fried egg, and then after a certain amount of time, take it out, and we don't use any fat. And once the egg starts to stick, we know that we've already worn out that nonstick coating. Our favorite pan, which is right now it's by OXO, it released up to 75 eggs with no sticking.
Wow.
And then we cook a bunch of other stuff in it, and we do that test again. A lot of pans don't make it through that second round. Some of them don't make it through the first round. So there's a real difference in the quality of the nonstick coating, and you want one that's going to hold up as long as possible. Because as we all know, nonstick coatings are not eternal. They're not like cast iron pans where you can renew that surface forever. It's going to go in one direction, which is downhill. And you just want more of a long, gradual slope to that landfill as long as you can. So look for a good one.
And a big point you make in your videos and your writing, Lisa, is these coated pans are not made to be cooked at super high heats. Can you talk about that?
Right. There's two kinds of nonstick coatings on the market right now. One is PTFE, which is polytetrafluoroethylene. And that is a chemical coating. It's the best nonstick out there. It really sticks. It sticks itself to the pan and doesn't stick to any food. But at about 500 degrees, it can start off-gassing. And so you'll see things where they say, don't keep your pet birds in the kitchen, et cetera. That's not great for you either. If you've ever heard of the story of the canary in the coal mine, you know, that they used to bring canaries into the coal mine because if the canary, you know, passed out, they knew they had a little bit more time to get out of there. It was not a good sign. So you know, don't get them over 500 degrees if you can help it. And that's kind of easy to do if you've cranked the heat to high, which is also why we always say don't preheat your nonstick pan without oil in it. Most oil will smoke at around 400 degrees. And so it will be smoking and you'll get a sign to get that thing off the heat long before it's dangerous to you.
Let's go back to
the other option is ceramic, actually. The other kind of coating is ceramic, and that has a higher heat tolerance as far as it doesn't really have a ceiling. Ceramic can be very, very hot. The only problem is it's not as durable for as long as PTFE coatings. It tends to get cracks in it. It's a little brittle. Once those cracks happen, it starts to stick, and then it just kind of perpetuates. It goes downhill a lot faster, but you don't have to worry about the off-gassing.
Let's go back to our callers. Linda is with us in Middleton. Linda, hi.
Hi. I would like to recommend a pan I got from Wisconsin Cutlery on University Avenue, and it is called a Kyrocera. It's a nonstick pan, and I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly.
How do you spell the name?
K-Y-O-C-E-R-A.
Kyocera. Okay, and what do you like about it, Linda?
Things don't stick, and it's super easy to clean.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, that's actually our Best Buy ceramic pan. We tested a full lineup of ceramic nonstick pans, and our winner is by Green Pan, the Valencia, and our Best Buy is that pan.
Well done, Linda. Thanks a lot. Good luck. I hope long life to that pan. It's Food Friday. We're talking to kitchen product reviewer Lisa McManus about skillets, what to buy, what to watch for, how to make the best use of them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you use mostly nonstick pans, what do you like about them? If you had a hard time using or caring for your cookware at all, if you're a cast iron fan, what's your secret? What's your strategy for keeping it as nonstick as possible? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with kitchen equipment reviewer Lisa McManus from America's Test Kitchen. We're talking about skillets, what to buy, when to use them, how to use them, how to care for them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite must-have pan in your collection? Is there something you'd want to recommend to someone else? Or do you need some advice from our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Clara is calling from on the road right now. Clara, hi. What did you want to bring up? Are you there, Clara? I think Claire's not hearing us. Claire wanted, I got a note to ask, about PFAS chemicals in nonstick pans. This is a big issue here in Wisconsin, Lisa. These PFAS chemicals in our waterways. Is that something you've been tracking as you look at nonstick pans?
Yes, it's a lot of concern with nonstick in that regard, because it's something that comes out during manufacturing. It's not in your pan when you're using it, but during manufacturing, it gets into the runoff, you know, that gets into the waterways, as I understand it. One of the options that we like to offer instead of nonstick, it's so easy to use. You know, we love that it's so easy. It releases food and, you know, it's easy to lift. It's lightweight compared to cast iron. But we really love to say, you know, try a carbon steel pan. Carbon steel has some great nonstick ability. It's natural nonstick. It's like cast iron in that you season it and you take care of it, and it gives you this beautiful release, but it's more lightweight than cast iron. So it's easier to handle for people who can't really hoist that giant cast iron pan around.
Clara, thanks for calling in. Sorry we lost that connection with you. Pat joins us now in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're excited about a pan, Pat. I can tell.
No, I'm excited. It's Friday and I'm done with work.
All right.
It's been a week of Mondays.
What did you want to tell us about?
My favorite is my 10-inch Lodge cast iron skillet. If I could find a older cast iron skillet than mine, I would love it even more. But I've been using that skillet for frying all sorts of different types of meats, steaks, the bacon, and everything else in between. But my absolute favorite use for it is making cornbread. That is my absolute favorite.
Awesome. Pat, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And that, yeah, Lisa, the one beauty about thing about cast iron skillets is they transfer really well into the oven, or I've used them on the grill as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, one way I tested the cast iron skillets that we have in our latest review is I baked cornbread in each and every one of them. And I have to agree, it makes the best cornbread.
Pat, thanks a lot for that. And you talk to a lot of people about pans and skillets, Lisa. My read is that if somebody's excited about a particular pan, it's going to be cast iron. That brings out the enthusiasm in some people, it seems like.
Absolutely. I mean, it's great. You know, people talk about vintage cast iron. Some of those are gorgeous pans, and it's so much fun to, you know, look for them in yard sales and get a great deal on them because people find them all rusty and think they're ruined, and they're not. You just scrub that rust off and oil it and heat it, and it's really ready to go again. And you really can't destroy those pans. And you could drive over them with a truck, they'd probably still be fine.
Pat, thanks
what
a lot.
What else can you say? You know, a kitchenware that you can buy something like that, and 100 years later, it's still going strong, right?
Thanks a lot, Pat, for calling in. Deborah is with us now in Elkhorn. Deborah, hi. Are you there, Deborah? Okay, Deborah wants some, Dutch oven recommendations. The one she has is coated on the inside, discolored, hard to clean. Lisa, I just got a Dutch oven. My wife got me one for Christmas. I didn't know I needed it. I love it. I'm using it so much. Any Dutch oven recommendations?
Oh, yeah, definitely. We love Dutch ovens in the test kitchen. We use them for so many things. You know, we fry in them. They're great for making fried chicken or French fries because they have their own splatter wall on the sides. We bake bread in them. They make the most amazing bread. And obviously soups and stews. So many ways that we use those things. But I would say if you are looking for a Dutch oven, our favorite has been Le Creuset for so many years. And then our best buy would be one from Cuisinart that's very similar. They both have that broad cooking surface I was talking about with skillets, very important. You can brown beef in fewer batches if you're making a stew, and there's less chance that anything's going to burn because you're not doing multiple batches. You may be able to get through all the beef that you're making in maybe two batches instead of four. And then light colored interior. And that gets to that question of it being stained. We like this cream colored interior because you can really see in that pan and you can judge the browning and you can tell if things are getting burned. There are some Dutch ovens that have a black interior. It's harder to judge if you're burning that fond, those blackened bits or browned bits at the bottom that really create a lot of the flavor in that soup or stew. So a light colored pan on the interior is what we look for, but they can discolor. And you really shouldn't worry too much about that. It's fine. It means you're using your pan. If it gets too dark, you can do one part of bleach to two parts of water. Let it soak overnight and rinse that out really well, and it will lighten up quite a bit, if not look good as new.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Linda is with us in Milwaukee. Linda, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say the fellow that called in with the Griswold, I think he's just got to slow down with that fry pan. Those are the best old cast iron fry pans, and let it heat up on the burner first, low, before he puts the food in. And you can do eggs over easy, stay everything. Just start it out, let it heat up completely first, and then when it comes to washing it, just pour hot water in it and let it sit, and then take a little scrub your a cloth and wash it out and rinse it with hot water and let it dry. Don't add any soap. And it's a wonderful thing.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. Oh, yeah, Lisa, I meant to ask. You mentioned cleaning without soap. Soap ruins our seasoning on cast iron skillets. Is that right?
Here's the thing. It won't ruin it if it's well-established seasoning. If it's newly established seasoning, you can kind of take a step back in the seasoning. It will break up the oil instead of, you know, letting it polymerize on the surface. So you don't want to remove the oil. You can actually just take the food out, rinse it with hot water, as the caller just said. She gave perfect advice. And then pat it dry, put it back on the stove, let it get nice and warm again, not super ripping hot, just fully warm, and the tiniest drops of oil, rub that in there. If you're worrying about old oil or old food, that is going to heat up, and it's not going to be unsanitary. It's not, you're not baking old food on there. You maybe have traces of the oil, but that will polymerize and become the coating of the pan. It's not unsanitary. So you don't need the soap. If you use a little bit of it, once the pan is well seasoned, it's not going to really hurt, but you really don't need to.
Linda, thanks a lot for that call. And Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It was so much fun.
That's Lisa McManus, executive editor for America's Test Kitchen Reviews. She joined us on Food Friday for a look at skillets. You could see more of her work in the popular America's Test Kitchen YouTube series called Gearheads. And you could keep sharing your pots and pans favorites over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you found an amazing old cast iron skillet, maybe at a garage sale somewhere that you rely on all the time. Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. The upcoming solar eclipse isn't the only big game in the skies. There's a comet on the way through with a devilish look about it. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a 10-mile-wide comet is passing through Earth's view right now as it heads to its closest point to the sun. It's got the catchy name 12/P Pons Brooks. It's got the easier-to-remember nickname Devil Comet, because some astronomers thought it looked a little like devil horns because of the way it spews out dust and gas. It's visible in the night sky here in Wisconsin. This weekend may be your best chance to see it. It'll be low in the sky, easiest to see early at night. You'll need binoculars or a backyard telescope to see it for sure, but if it flares up, we can see it with just our eyes. Which way do you look to see it? Not very good at giving space directions or following them. Probably look it up online at jsonline.com, NPR, or space.com. And as always, hope for clear skies. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever heard people talk to each other in online video games, or played a game yourself with live conversation, or maybe followed the chat on game streaming sites like Twitch, you may have seen how toxic those environments can be, especially for women, people of color, and the LGBTQ community. They can be even worse than social media comments on, say, Twitter, or X, or Facebook. It can look like an anything-goes situation, but there have been some efforts by companies to create safer gaming spaces. The game company Ubisoft recently introduced their own Good Game Playbook, which outlines what good online conduct looks like and how gamers can protect themselves from harassment. Others have various types of moderation and reporting systems. Our next guest studies online communities and what can be done to prevent harassment and create positive spaces in online gaming and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you play online games, or maybe do your kids? Do you follow game streamers? Have you witnessed or experienced harassment in those spaces? What kind of things would you like to see to create more friendly environments? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Yvette Wan is an associate professor of informatics and director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Yvette, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, for people who haven't spent a lot of time in this world, whether playing, you know, live online games or following streamers on Twitch, can you give us a sense of some of the worst case? How bad can things get?
Well, we've talked to a lot of people who have been subject of these kind of harassment, and we've heard like really, really bad stories, including people who show up to people's houses in person because they somehow found their personal information. And then a lot of things that I don't feel comfortable talking about on public radio, but it really ranges from, you know, the mild name calling to very serious situations.
That seems like the solutions I've seen over the years in a lot of online platforms is A, do nothing. I hope it kind of sorts itself out. B, having reporting and maybe blocking mechanisms, things like that. I was interested in this thing from Ubisoft. We've seen other similar things where they're trying to say, hey, instead of just focusing on reacting, we're going to try to set the ground rules for positive interaction online. What do you think of that approach?
I think that's something that scholars have been advocating for a very long time, because the analogy I like to make is a park. Like, if you go into a park and there's garbage everywhere, then people will probably think, oh, it's okay for me to throw away garbage here, right? But if it's like very clean and pristine, then you might think twice about, you know, just throwing garbage on the ground. And so I think that's the same with online communities. Like, depending on what you think is the norm of what should be happening there, I think that influences people's behaviors.
I want to look at some of your research now, Yvette. You focused on Twitch streams and how moderation works. Again, for people who haven't participated in this, can you talk about, so if I set up a Twitch stream, I play I play a video game of some sort, and then people can type into a chat along the way. Can you talk about what moderation looks like in that kind of chat?
Right. Twitch is very unique. Of course, it's not just for game streaming. Like, any kind of live streaming is possible on Twitch. And what is a little bit different from other social media is that things happen in real time. So as the person who is broadcasting is delivering whatever kind of content they're doing, in real time, you see the comments on the, you know, on one side of the screen, and it's like moving very fast because people are talking there. And so that poses a very interesting challenge, because what that means is that as things are happening, you need to be aware of what kind of comments are happening in real time. And it's a little bit different from like posting on an online forum, for example, where there's like a slight delay between when somebody posts and when somebody sees it. So it's not only like a social challenge, but also a technical challenge as well.
And have you seen successful approaches to that, as you say, real-time moderation?
So I think, things are definitely getting better. Like, even in the past few years, we've seen a lot of improvement. The moderation on Twitch or any kind of social media is a very complex process that not only involves like technical solutions such as like AI, but also real humans. And so we have actual human beings reading the comments and making decisions on the fly about whether those should be deleted or reported, or whether the person should be removed or given a warning. And so Twitch has a very interesting structure where each stream has its own moderators. So in some sense, the governance of the platform is very decentralized. And so each streamer needs to decide how it is that they want to run their channel.
We're talking to Yvette Wan from the New Jersey Institute of Technology, looking at moderation of online communities, especially often toxic chats or conversations in online gaming and game streaming. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences, maybe something you've seen yourself or your kid has encountered. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hey, Rob. This is actually a great idea for the show. I have seen this myself. I'm an avid gamer. I've played a lot of online games where the vitriol on it is insane. It goes from the mundane, a couple swears, to just racist, homophobic, and it is sad. But like your expert Yvette was saying, that it's getting better. I see that a lot of times they're able to do live banning or live censoring of words. And then also when it's up to the players themselves and the viewers to do the reporting, that it's getting taken care of. I personally play a mobile game that's like Call of Duty, and whenever someone gets reported, the developers are looking into it, and they're actually looking at chat logs, and they're looking at video replays, and they're making sure that these people aren't doing anything that's against the rules or anything that is, you know, not acceptable. And also it even goes farther than just words and actions. It's more actions in game. If you're doing something that people don't like, they'll ban you for it. So it's
Michael,
getting better.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience. And Yvette, a few years ago, I know I'd heard from people saying, I don't even bother to report because I don't think anything is going to happen when I report. Is that, as Michael suggests, changing?
That's absolutely correct. I think the thing about content moderation is that companies are under no legal obligation to do this. And so for a very long time, they didn't do it because, you know, it takes a lot of money and resources to run that kind of program. But what they've realized over the years is that especially it's different now because a lot of games are online and social, right? As opposed to like 20, 30 years ago, where it was just like a person at home playing with their own computer. And so now they know that if they don't create a great environment, they're going to lose a lot of potential players.
Thanks again for that call. Michael, Yvette Wan is with us, Associate Professor of Informatics, Director of the Social Interaction Lab at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, talking about efforts to curb harassment in online gaming spaces and other online communities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories, whether they're from this morning or from years ago, of bad experiences in online gaming communities? Or have you had positive experiences? Have you seen things change over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about efforts to train people for work in professional senior care and a program that started here in Wisconsin. Our guests are Shay Van Eyl, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire, and Doug Olson, president and CEO of Vision Center. That's a nonprofit that works on these issues, bringing lessons from Wisconsin to the rest of the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Doug, can you talk about the gaps you see out there and the kind of academic training, the kind of work you've done in Eau Claire and now around the country that you're trying to fill here?
Really focused around coordinating partnerships between providers and universities, providing a new narrative about the field, and also providing resources. We started this journey about 5 years ago with a sabbatical I did, bringing together all these stakeholders across the various sectors of the field. And once we got started with that, what turned out to be a project turned into momentum, and now is an initiative that is really focused around trying to bring universities to a place where they're graduating more students that are either at an undergraduate, graduate, or even a mid-career from university programs. So we started working with about 20 universities. We moved that up to about 40, and now once we launched last fall, it's been about 60. And we're working with them in a variety of ways to help them accelerate the development and growth of these programs. These are not programs, like Shay said, you know, these are not programs that someone comes into a university always and is really, it's not front and center like accounting or biology or chemistry or nursing. And so we've really tried to raise the bar around what we're doing with universities across the country. And we have done some things around assessing what early career paths people are looking for from a student perspective. We're doing some innovative stuff around field experiences. That is really what Shay talked about, is the secret sauce of these programs. That's really where the hands-on learning and problem solving and really understanding how you're working with people and for people really happen. I always get a kick out of Shay saying she learned more in 3 months in her field experience than she did on campus. But it's so critically important. And you know, we've really worked hard. We do a symposium every year. We have webinars. We have other things that are really kind of advancing the field. And you know, when you mention it grew out of Eau Claire, there's a lot of best practices that came from Eau Claire. But there's a lot of things we're learning as we work with other universities across the country. We're working with universities in the West, the Midwest, the east, the south, and each of them come from different kind of perspectives. Some will come out of a hospitality school, some come out of a business school, some come out of a health science school. So collectively, we're kind of all learning together, and we're making great progress.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nancy is with us in Grafton. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I just have to tell you that I had a very, very large family. I had a lot of children of my own, but I always had wanted to be a nurse. And, of course, then it was a little too late to go to college or school to be a nurse. But I could be a nursing assistant, and I went to tech school, and I was a nursing assistant at our county nursing home for a long, long time. And I'm telling you, I loved the people that I cared for. And the thing is, it reminded me of when my dad was in a nursing home up in up north. Anyhow, I went to see him one day, and the door was closed, and knocked on the door, and the gal said, "Oh, you can't come in now. We're doing a dressing." I said, "I'm coming in. I'm a nursing assistant. I've seen it all." I had not seen it all. My father was I could see his bones in his back because obviously they had not transferred him or taken care of him and turned him and such things. And then I called the state and I told them, and they told me that they were only following doctor's orders. And I'm telling you, I never saw anything like that before. But even after I retired from the, from our county nursing home here, I took care of so many people. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, with them when they died in their homes. And
Nancy, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but thanks for sharing your experience. And Ashay, I'm hearing from Nancy the value of caring if you're going into this line of work. And really, it sounds like based on her experience with her dad, she wanted to put all of herself into the care she was giving to people. How important is that, being willing to have that, I guess, that emotional vested interest in the work you're doing?
It's huge. It's the long-term care industry is hard. It is not easy. It's not even fun some days. And it is something that if you do not have the passion for this field, you're not going to succeed. And that's why these paid internships are so big, because it gives you the opportunity to see if this is what you want to do before you jump in, because the residents and the staff don't deserve someone who doesn't care. And that is something that my current preceptor is huge on, is these grow-as-you-go programs where she wants the CNAs to become TMAs and RNs and LPNs and directors of nursing. She wants to encourage the passion with everyone and show them that they can be more than what they are today. If they have the passion, they can do anything in this field.
Nancy, thanks for sharing your experience. We're talking about an effort to bring more people into senior care at the highest levels and at all points. Doug Olson is with us, president and CEO of the group Vision Center, and Shay Van Eyl is at UW-Eau Claire studying to do this. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Doug, you and Shay have both said something along the lines of, you know, nobody goes into college thinking they're going to go into this line of work. You know, I know some fields were reaching into high school saying, hey, put this on your radar as a potential career. Is that maybe a next step?
Yeah, we are already. First of all, Nancy, I'm sorry about that one situation mm-hmm. with your loved one. I also worked as a nursing assistant, and I would echo what Shay said. It takes passion. It's hard work. They're never paid enough for what they do, and I think society really values. During COVID, we saw how much family members and community members valued, how much those staff members really contributed to the quality of life for their person. You know, one of the things that we are doing, Rob, is we are reaching into high schools and colleges to get the perspective from these new emerging leaders so that we're really talking about the profession of senior living leadership in a way that kind of resonates with, kind of away from the stigmas and the stereotypes of this is a profession that every day you make a difference for a loved one or a staff member. And you have a tremendous impact. I often say to people that the real test of a country is, you know, how they treat those that are underserved or underprivileged or frail. I think that is really the moral compass that our country really should be thinking about. And I think you mentioned before, I mean, that silver tsunami is right there at the front door. Many people would say, why did you start this, Doug? I would say we should have started it 5 years ago. One of the things that is clear across the country is that we are definitely needing to make sure that we have people, because you talked about there'll be more people over 80 by the year 2032 than that are under 18. This is one of those kind of demographics in our country that's maturing that is really going to have to pay attention to how we do what we do, and we're going to have to do it differently. And that's why there's a lot of creative new solutions around how do we really take care of people's loved ones.
And Shay, given the time of year right now, somebody might actually be in their car getting ready to be dropped off on their campus for their freshman year. Talk directly to them, if you will, to put these careers in senior care on their radar, maybe if it's something they hadn't even thought of before.
I think it's really just about keeping your eyes open. And one of my biggest things, I was terrified to change my major and terrified to look elsewhere because I had felt like I failed. And that was not the case. If it is, I failed upwards, so I'm okay with that. But I would say just get involved. Take 101 classes that maybe aren't up your alley, but they could turn into something so much more. Be a part of the student organizations. You're not a nerd if you are. They are fun, and they help you make friends, and it helps you find where you're supposed to be. And you will find it, and you will fall in where you're supposed to be, and it is very rewarding once you get there.
And Doug, let's speak directly to another audience now. Maybe somebody's out there listening who works at or maybe even runs some kind of senior care facility, and they're not involved with Vision Center yet. Speak to them and how they can get involved.
Well, what I would tell them is that, one, they can contact me directly at dolson@visioncenter.org, and there's also the train has left the station. There's lots of room on the train yet, and if people want to get involved, there's a variety of ways to do that, whether that's being involved and connecting with the university themselves, whether it means finding a placement for a student that wants to do an internship in this field. We really, really understand the value proposition of having someone new to the field with lots of different perspectives that really want to make a difference as a valuable asset for any senior living organization, that is, whether it's assisted living, senior housing, skilled nursing, home and community-based services. There's a broad spectrum, and we're going to need all of them. And what I will also tell, you know, the listeners is that it's also a very, very rewarding career that is got a lot of growth opportunities, and it's one of those things that I don't think you will ever look back, just like Shay said earlier.
We'll leave it there. Doug and Shay, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to Doug Olson, president and CEO of Vision Center, a nonprofit organization focused on leadership development for aging services, and Shay Van Isle, currently pursuing a degree in healthcare administration at UW-Eau Claire. We talked to them about Eau Claire's successful program, training the next generation of senior care professionals.